If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today, Ridley Scott's new film, The Last Duel, hits UK cinemas. Set in 14th century France, the film dramatises a real case of trial by combat. But what exactly was trial by combat? When was it used? And what were the rules? Medievalist Professor Hannah Skoder joined me to explain all. But please be aware, this conversation does include some fairly grisly details of medieval combat. So thank you so much for joining me to speak all about trial by combat in the medieval era. So part of the reason that we're having this conversation today is because there's a new film coming out called The Last Duel. And that movie is based on a book, but a book is inspired by a real French case from 1386. So we'll save any spoilers until right at the end of the podcast. So if anybody's listening and wants to go watch it, then don't worry. We're not going to spoil it for you immediately. But what can you tell us about the real case, the real duel that inspired the film?
So there are three main protagonists to the story. There's a noblewoman called Marguerite de Carrouges, and her husband, Jean de Carrouges, and another nobleman involved called Jacques Legris. And when Jean de Carrouges was off at war, Marguerite claimed that Jacques turned up at her home, burst in and raped her. And she tells her husband when he gets back that this has happened. They take the case to the court of the Count of Alençon, and they don't get the desired verdict. So Jean de Carrouges then requests to the Parlement of Paris, which is not like the English Parliament, which is why I'm not saying Parliament, but Parlement, it's a different kind of judicial system. Anyway, he requests the right for a trial by combat to prove the case against Jacques Legris. And the Parlement of Paris has to think about it, and they investigate and they decide, yes, he has the right to challenge Jacques Legris to a trial by combat. So they fight it out in front of a huge audience. And Marguerite, who is by this point heavily pregnant, has to watch the entire thing effectively in chains, because if her husband loses the combat, not only will he die and then be executed, but she will also be burned. If he wins, Jacques Legris will die on the battlefield, but he will then also posthumously be executed in the most humiliating way possible.
So it's incredibly high stakes stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
So how is a trial by combat different to just a duel?
It's a great question, because it's really tempting to think that they're sort of the same thing, but they're not. They're very different in their logic. So a duel is quite simply one person challenging another on a point of honour and fighting it out. The idea of a trial by combat is that this is a form of ordeal. It's a form of what's called judicium Dei, so the judgment of God. You're pitting two people, one against the other, and you're asking God to show who's in the right.
So we might return to the case that we discussed earlier right at the end. As I say, we might reveal a few spoilers about what happened then. But let's delve into the broader history of trial by combat. So what kind of cases was it used in?
It's used in a huge range of cases. So we hear first of all about trial by combat sort of emerging in the 6th century, in Germanic lands particularly. And it's used for treason. It's used for various kinds of sexual offences, not just rape, things like adultery as well. It's used in cases of arson. It's used in cases of poisoning. And then it's used in a whole range of cases to do with property as well. So it ranges from sort of criminal to civil to political offences. They turn to it in many, many circumstances.
So you mentioned earlier that it's essentially a judicial process and that it's based on the idea of ordeal. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about the ideas that underline it and how it was justified.
So there are different kinds of ordeal which are available to judicial authorities in the Middle Ages. There's perhaps more famously, actually, trial by fire and trial by water. And the logic of all these is kind of similar. The idea is that you basically don't really have enough proof by human means one way or the other. So you're going to put it to God to figure out and to make visible who is the guilty party and who is the innocent party. It's a bit different from trial by fire and water in that those really depend on a miracle. The idea is that God will protect the innocent party from what would naturally happen to them if they stick their hand in a vat of boiling oil or if they walk across boiling plowshares. And the idea is that God will show they're innocent by protecting their flesh from the wounds that would normally happen by doing these things. Trial by combat appeals to God to make a judgment, but it looks very familiar in the sense that no miracle is expected. This really is just two people fighting it out in the most brutal way possible.
So the idea is that God will back his candidate, the one in the right, and they will emerge victorious.
Yeah, exactly. And there are all kinds of problems with that, not just from a modern perspective, but the thing that really strikes me is that medieval people were doubtful and sceptical and anxious about this in all kinds of ways right from the start of the process. So already in the 8th century, the Lombard king writes that he's anxious because he puts many men have lost their case unjustly through trial by combat. There's a real sense that it can deliver the wrong verdict.
So was it simply that not everybody believed that God necessarily was involved?
So it's partly a sense that you really are effectively leaving it to two people to fight it out. And actually the person who's better at fighting or the person who has more luck on the day is going to win. But there's also a kind of set of theological problems as well. And the church from very early on says this is unacceptable, in fact, and they won't have anything to do with it. And part of that is based on a sense that it's wrong to encourage people to shed blood, which is a somewhat hypocritical stance on the part of the church in the Middle Ages, but still, you're not supposed to tell people to shed blood. So that's one of the problems. But the other problem from a theological perspective is that you're testing God effectively. You're sort of putting God to the test in a way which is really blasphemous. And churchmen across many centuries say, you must not do this. You shouldn't be putting God to the test. And they say that the final judgment of God will be revealed at the last judgment, not, you know, on a certain day in 1386 when the king has decreed there's going to be a trial by combat. So there's a sort of a sense of skepticism from a kind of rational perspective that, you know, things can just go wrong in this. But there's also a kind of set of theological reasonings which says this is a really problematic and potentially blasphemous thing to do.
So if the church was opposed to trial by combat, how did they end up happening? Is the idea that you would go to your lord, your king, and then there wouldn't be an adequate judgment, so you would end up doing trial by combat? Was it always a last resort?
I think it becomes increasingly a last resort over the course of the Middle Ages. So when it starts off in the 6th, 7th, 8th centuries, at that stage it's a despite these kind of elements of scepticism, which I've been describing, it's nevertheless a kind of relatively accepted way of dealing with things. Actually, the Carolingians are really quite pro trial by combat, partly because it replaces the need for oaths, particularly about property disputes. And they say, well, oaths are really morally problematic because loads of people perjure themselves. At least if you fight it out, you just fight it out and that's that. So maybe that's a bit better. Anyway, so there's a sort of acceptance that it's quite a useful thing early on. But then the further we go into the Middle Ages, the more it becomes something that you turn to when everything else has failed. So King Philip IV of France in the early 14th century, for example, he's really not very keen on trial by combat for the sorts of reasons we've been discussing. But he says if there are no witnesses, if the thing happened in secret, if you have no other form of proof, this is something that might be turned to at that point.
So we've mentioned a few examples from France. Was trial by combat found elsewhere across Europe?
Yeah, it seems to be really widespread. So the first examples are in Burgundian lands in the early Middle Ages, and then it seems to kind of radiate out from there. So say there are lots of French examples, there are lots of Burgundian examples, there are lots of examples sort of throughout what we might broadly term Germanic lands. Trial by combat reaches the British Isles, we think probably in the 11th century after the Norman conquest. And there are some fairly dramatic examples at that point.
Can you tell us about some of those?
So, well, for example, 1095, so just after the Norman conquest, William of Eu in Normandy, who's now then in England, obviously, he's accused of treason, and they fight it out, a trial by combat. And the result of that is the loser is to have his eyes gouged out and he's then to be castrated. So it's about as gruesome as it gets, really. 1157 is another really notable case. Robert de Montfort accused Henry of Essex of betraying the king, which is, you know, an accusation of treason is the most kind of destructive accusation that you could pit against another nobleman. Anyway, and Robert wins in the trial by combat, and it is said that he wins even though he is most definitely the weaker man. So this really is supposed to have been an example of divine intervention, and it was said that Robert benefited from the miraculous intervention of St. Edmund, who you know, kind of gave him the strength that he would need suddenly to defeat the other guilty party.
We've talked a bit about the way that you might end up in a trial by combat, but let's talk about the trial by combat itself. So set the scene for us. Is this mainly noblemen that would be fighting? And was it a public spectacle? Were people invited along to come and watch? And what might that crowd look like?
So I think one of the things that's really interesting about trial by combat is that it's not limited to noblemen. Pretty much everybody can be involved in a trial by combat. So townsmen, those sort of right across the social spectrum. There are even cases of women being involved, Jewish people being involved, which is really interesting. And quite often people would be expected to appoint a champion to fight on their behalf. So, I don't know, a woman is unlikely to have to enter the lists and fight against, I don't know, a knight of some sort. She will appoint a champion to fight on her behalf. So it's pretty widespread. But I think nevertheless, we can see a kind of waiting towards noblemen fighting trial by combat. Certainly towards the end of the period, it's much more likely to be noblemen, aristocrats who are doing this. Anyway, it's a very, very public spectacle. This is not something, you know, kind of pistols at dawn with like one witness or something. It's a big public event. So the case that this film, The Last Duel, is based on, the King of France knew that he would be away for the date that the trial by combat was set to be fought on. So he actually makes them delay it so that he can return and watch, because he is so keen on being there. He really, really doesn't want to miss this spectacle. Anyway, so huge audiences, again, crowds sort of from right across the social spectrum. It's not just their peers who will be watching. And I think probably by the 14th century, crowds which are particularly big, precisely because this is less common by this stage. It's quite an anachronistic kind of thing to be taking place in 1386. So, you know, it really is an unusual event and people want to be there. They take place very often in kind of specially constructed, what we call lists. So these are sort of, I don't know, like kind of a stadium for a tournament to be fought in. But the idea is that it's a kind of bounded space, which will be prepared especially, sometimes an island. the idea is that then nobody can run away. Everybody's there sort of watching it happen, you know, in a sense, kind of on the pitch.
So it has echoes really of like a gladiators tournament.
I think that's a really striking comparison, actually. Yeah, it does. I mean, the reasoning behind it is very, very different. But this sense of kind of spectacle and I don't know, I'm not quite sure whether I'd use the word entertainment because I think people in the Middle Ages are shocked and horrified by violence. But you can be drawn to it, can't you? And still want to kind of be there at a, you know, a sort of historic moment, but at the same time be horrified by what's going on.
So you mentioned earlier that some people use champions to fight in their place. Mm. What were the rules around that? Would the champion be somebody related to you or might it be somebody that you hired, for example?
I think most often somebody that one hires. So it could be somebody who's related and sometimes it will be somebody who's a particular supporter for one reason or another, like a nephew or a brother or something. But there are professional champions as well who will fight on behalf of people, which seems like a fairly lousy job to do, really, for all sorts of reasons. But
to me, then, doesn't that seem that it's quite often would just be a case of who could buy the best man to fight for them? So the richer man would often win. Do you think that would be fair?
That certainly sounds very fair to me. And in a sense, the kinds of problems that people are aware of with judicial systems more generally, that justice tends to favour the powerful, I think in many ways are kind of even more visible and exacerbated with trial by combat.
Mm. And what are some of the ritualistic elements that were involved in a trial by combat?
So it's really interesting because trial by fire and water has a really striking kind of liturgical set of rituals to go with the ordeal. And the clergy have to be involved because there's this, as I say, kind of quasi-liturgical sense. For trial by combat, that's not the case to the same extent. So the fact that the church is really opposed to it from quite an early stage actually doesn't matter so much because they don't need them so much because they don't have all this kind of religious ritual around it. Having said that, at the start of a trial by combat, there are a lot of oaths which need to be sworn. So the combatants need to swear once again, you know, what it is that they're claiming they have or haven't done. And then they need to swear various oaths saying that they're not going to use any magic or necromancy or sorcery. They've got no hidden advantages. And they need to swear on holy relics or the Bible that they're not going to cheat in any way like this, that they really are putting it to the judgment of God. So in that sense, it's very ritualistic and there are lots of kind of rules to get them started. But the thing that really strikes me about trial by combat once they do start is that there are virtually no rules then. It's absolutely brutal. So when we think about duels, I think we tend to think about a very codified kind of violence, don't we? So whether it's with swords or whether it's a kind of later pistols at dawn sort of thing, it's like a certain way you need to do it. And you know, you walk so many steps and then you turn around at a particular moment, that kind of thing. Trial by combat is, it's just absolutely brutal. It's like you just go for this person in any way you possibly can. And all the sort of usual rules of chivalry really don't apply. You are just trying to kill your opponent by whatever means possible. So people sometimes they're told just to use clubs and shields. In the case of Jean de Carrouge and Jacques Legris, they're kind of fully armed as knights, but they unhorse one another pretty quickly. They kill each other's horses in gruesome ways. It's really distressing and really horrible. And then they just go for one another. All the usual sort of, you know, brave chivalric exploits don't apply. Use whatever you can. So there are lots of examples of people using their teeth to kind of rip off each other's noses or grabbing each other's testicles or ripping off kind of ears or whatever body part you can grab hold of. It's really, really undignified stuff and absolutely brutal.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
People think about law and judgment and right and wrong and the role of divine intervention in really interesting ways.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
That comparison you made with Jules is really interesting, because you'd think Jules primarily often were based on, say, crimes of passion and immediate response to that, but somehow they were more structured in a sense, whereas this was a judicial process, but then was essentially a free-for-all once you got started, which seems counterintuitive.
It seems very counterintuitive. I quite agree. Yeah. No, but I continue to be struck and horrified in many of these accounts by just how disgusting it is as well. And there's even one of the kind of law manuals describing how to go about a judicial duel offers a bit of advice. It says a good technique is to go for your opponent's nose with your teeth. So you know, this the kind of brutality and the what you've described as a kind of free-for-all is really encouraged. That's the way you do it.
So how do you win a trial by combat? Is it only won by the death of one party, or can you subdue somebody and win that way?
So you basically need to get the other party to the point where they admit defeat. And most often that's going to be because they're dead. Because they know that as soon as they admit defeat, they're going to be put to death anyway, because that's what this whole thing was trying to prove. So sometimes people admit defeat before they're quite dead, but it's because they are literally in such a state, there is absolutely nothing they can do, and they sense they're dying. So it's not, it's not as if you have to be, once you've kind of broken your leg or something, you only say, okay, I submit. You wait until the very last moment and you do everything you possibly can to win this.
And if it was so bloody and brutal, you know, people hacking each other's noses off, that kind of thing, I imagine that quite often both parties would be seriously injured. Where did that leave events?
That's a really good question. So there are cases where everybody ends up dead. And contemporaries comment on the complete pointlessness of this. So there's a really interesting example in the early medieval text of Gregory of Tours, where he describes a trial by combat where both the parties involved died. And he says, well, what was the point of that then? What's that proved?
So how successful do you think it was as a means of settling disputes? I mean, obviously, we can't determine whether the outcomes reflected the reality of the crime, but did it usually leave a situation more peaceful than it had been before?
I think there's a real sense that there are advantages to the trial by combat. So, I mean, in a sense, the verdict that it delivers will at least be definitive, even if it's wrong. And I think contemporaries kind of respect that sense that it may be wrong, but it is nevertheless definitive. And it's really striking that, so the church is finds it really problematic. Kings and emperors find it increasingly problematic over the course of the Middle Ages. They, by the late 13th century, they're really trying to sort of say, let's really limit this, or let's ban it altogether. But aristocrats want it to continue. They really fight for it to continue. So 1314, there's what's called the Leagues of Nobles in France, and they're rebelling about various things. But one of their central demands is to be allowed to continue with trial by combat, because they really value it. The King of France has had enough of it by this stage. He thinks it's a bad idea. But they really want to continue with it. And I think part of the reason is the sort of definitive closure that it gives, but also because it's bound up with ideas of honour and kind of a really macho kind of masculinity in ways that really kind of fit the sort of ethos and the culture of violence of which they're a part. So there are certainly, you know, there are groups who value this and who find it really useful and a way of kind of making visible everything that matters to them.
So you've described that there were two quite polarized opinions really about trial by combat. On the one hand, the church that opposed it. On the other hand, the aristocracy really wanted it to continue. How is it represented in art and literature of the time?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, well, it varies as ever. So there are some texts which give us some wonderfully kind of rich accounts of trial by combat in a way that sort of fits the plot perfectly. And it really seems to kind of sustain the system. And then there are others which really point to just how problematic it is. So the Song of Roland, which is probably the greatest medieval epic or chanson de geste, which was first committed to manuscript in the early 12th century, tells the story of Ganelon, who's an evil traitor who betrays Roland, the nephew of Charlemagne. Anyway, there's a long story to do with that. And then at the end of the text, Ganelon is, of course, accused of being a traitor, having basically had Roland die in a really horrific way. And Ganelon says, "I'm not a traitor. I did this because I hate Roland and it was my personal revenge on him. It's not treachery." And one of Ganelon's relatives, a guy called Pinabel, steps forward and says, "That's right, it was just revenge. And I'm willing to fight to say it was just revenge." And then dead Roland's best friend, a guy called Thierry, steps forward and he says, "No, it wasn't. It was treachery. And I'm going to fight to demonstrate that." So Pinabel and Thierry fight it out in a trial by combat. Pinabel has 30 guarantors for him. Thierry has one guarantor, the Emperor Charlemagne. They fight it out. Thierry is the much smaller man. He's much weaker, but of course he wins. And the text says, you know, this really is an example of God showing which side right was on. And Pinabel is then killed in a horrible way. All his 30 guarantors are put to death too, which is not remotely in line with any judicial tradition, but it's a chanson de geste, an epic. So that's what they do. And Ganelon, on whose behalf Pinabel was fighting, is then tied to four horses, each of his limbs, who run in different directions and tear him apart. So anyway, so that's kind of trial by combat as judgment of God. It all goes smoothly, not for Pinabel and his guarantors and Ganelon, but still it's the logic of it is kind of essential to the text. And then one might look at something else like the Renard stories, which kind of get going in a similar period, but remain popular all the way through the Middle Ages, as does the Song of Roland. And Renard is a wicked little fox. And he does all these dreadful, dreadful things all the way through the stories. And in the end, his kind of best friend slash enemy, the wolf, challenges him to a trial by combat because Renard's raped his wife. And they fight it out. Isengrin wins the trial by combat, but and it's really, really disgusting. I won't give you all the details because it's absolutely gruesome. But Renard then kind of springs back to life and carries on and does all kinds of other horrific things. So the text is, it's supposed to be very humorous. It depends on your sense of humor. But it's sort of playfully saying, well, you can try a trial by combat, but it won't make any difference. Everything will carry on. People will be as violent as they always have been. And, you know, it can be manipulated like everything else can be manipulated.
Mm. And were there any other really notable real cases that were often kind of commented on or that were seen as particularly foundational or particularly interesting?
Well, the foundational case that everybody's interested in is the biblical story of David and Goliath. In some ways, that's the kind of original trial by combat, mm-hmm. though it's obviously not set up like that in the Old Testament, but still that's the kind of story that people can refer to sort of set up the logic of how God will protect the weak and enable a small boy essentially to overcome this great giant because right is on his side. A really interesting case was also fought in 1386, the same year as the so-called, according to the film, Last Duel, which is commented on quite widely precisely because it sort of problematizes trial by combat. So it's fought between two noblemen. One of them's called Gérard de Mortagne and the other one's called Gilles, and he's the Lord of Busigny. And anyway, so they fight it out in the lists. They both have kind of sort of second supporters. And there's a huge audience. Everybody's really excited about this, but everybody's really dubious and worried about it as well. And their seconds rush onto the lists or the pitch and try and pull them apart and say, just don't do it. It's a really stupid way of resolving this. And the Duke of Lorraine, who's the Duke kind of overseeing the whole thing, also says, just stop it. Please stop it. It's a really bad idea. And eventually they're separated and the Duke of Lorraine has them both to dinner. And he gets his daughter to have a chat to them and say, could you just stop this, please? And just submit it to the court and we'll deal with it that way and it will all be okay. And anyway, so they all have dinner together and sort of end happily ever after. But I think it's a really interesting example of this kind of aristocratic attachment to the duel. A big audience who was sort of interested and excited, but at the same time worried about the implications of this. And the Duke and his daughter who see this as really problematic. So at this stage, by the late 14th century, there's a set of discussions happening which are really interesting.
Mm. So a rare happy ending there.
yes, exactly.
Quite a few of the stories that we've mentioned have involved women in some way, but obviously not in a fighting role. And you've also written a feature for our website tying into The Last Duel as a film about medieval violence towards women. Where do you see that fitting into this story?
So what I'm really struck by is sort of twofold. Firstly, that historians for so long have been really focused on the men who are involved in these stories and have lost sight of the fact that it's actually women who are at their heart. So the film is based on this story of Marguerite and her husband and this other man, Jacques Legris. And it's very tempting to think of this just as the last duel between Jean de Carrouges and Jacques Legris. But of course it isn't. It's really the story of Marguerite. And as I say, I think it's quite easy to lose sight of that. And it's really, really important to put women again center stage and think about the role that they played and the kind of key that they provide to understanding what's going on and to think about their experiences. The second thing I'm struck by is the sheer courage of women like Marguerite. So medieval attitudes to rape were actually extremely complex. It's really tempting just to say that medieval society was so barbaric that rape was endemic and no one really cared. And that's absolutely not true. Rape law is extremely hard line. But nevertheless, the stakes for women in bringing a case of rape were stacked extremely high, partly just because the burden of proof was so high, and partly because in bringing a case, a woman needed to accept, or a victim survivor needed to accept, that if the guilty party, or sorry, if the person she's accusing was found innocent, then she may well be punished herself. And in the case of the last duel, Marguerite stands to be burned if the man she's accused is found innocent. So my question really is, why did women bring these cases when they know the stakes are quite so high? The conviction rate is, of course, very, very low then as now. Why did they do it? And I think part of the answer there lies in immense courage, actually, courage and conviction, and a sense that, you know, speaking out really, really matters, even if you're likely to end up being punished or at least socially completely ostracized for doing that.
Mm. As you've mentioned before, the last duel wasn't necessarily really the last duel. How did the practice of trial by combat come to an end?
It just sort of peters out, actually. So I think by the 1380s, it already feels pretty anachronistic. It's quite surprising that Jean de Carrouges demands this. I think it's partly just because he hates Jacques Legris quite so much. There's a long-standing hostility between the two of them anyway. At one point, they were best friends, and then they fall out for a range of reasons. So part of this is because he really, really, really hates him, and he wants publicly to destroy him. But it's an unusual thing to do by then, and it just effectively becomes more and more unusual to do this. It also just becomes harder and harder. So as royal law develops, particularly Roman law, over the course of the sort of from the 13th century onwards, really, there's less of a place for trial by combat. Kings are more and more opposed to it because they see it as undermining their authority. It doesn't fit in with the new kind of judicial processes which are developing and the ways in which court systems are developing. So I think the last, absolute last judicial duel is fought in France in 1580, and the final judicial duel is fought in England in 1597. But those really are outliers. It's sort of not the thing to do by then because it doesn't fit in with the ways in which kind of royal systems of law have developed.
So I'm sure by this point in the conversation, a lot of listeners will be dying to know what happened in the case of Marguerite and Jack Lacree. So if anybody wants to go and see The Last Duel and doesn't want any spoilers, as we say, these are historical spoilers, not spoilers for the film, but they may give us a clue of what's going to happen. What did happen then, Hannah? How did this duel come to an end?
So the fight lasts a really long time. So the spectators who'd come kind of got their money's worth in a sense. The spectacle was extremely dramatic. And Jacques Lacree does look like the stronger man. And he seems to be largely gaining the upper hand over Jean de Carrouges. Anyway, they first of all, they charge at each other on their horses. They manage to dismount one another. The horses die horrible, horrible deaths. They carry on foot for a very long time. And then finally, Jean de Carrouges manages to rip the visor from Jacques Lacree's face and bury his sword in him. And that's the end of it. So Jacques Lacree dies on the lists in front of this huge audience. But his body is then executed posthumously in order to make the point that he is the guilty party and he is therefore to be punished as a rapist, as a criminal. And Jean de Carrouges then, whose sort of career had been on a bit of a downturn, finds himself showered with rewards. He's this great hero and he's kind of made after that.
So what would you hope to see in the film The Last Duel as a historian of this subject?
I think primarily, I really hope that Marguerite is given centre stage and that audiences really hear her voice and that audiences are encouraged to respect her voice and to start from a position of believing her. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I don't know what really happened. It was 1386 and I wasn't there. But I think it's really important that as historians, we start from the perspective of thinking the stakes for women were so high in bringing a case like this. There is not the slightest reason why they would have done it viciously, simply in order to maliciously bring somebody else down. I simply cannot imagine why she would have done that. She risks mm-hmm. being burned. And I hope that audiences will look at the film and see her extraordinary courage and really respect that. On a side note, I think it'd be really nice as well to see a vision of the Middle Ages, which showed the kind of sophistication and complexity of legal thought and the ways in which people kind of problematize these really weird sort of practices. I mean, looking at it from the 21st century, it seems just bizarre anybody could have thought this was a good way to resolve case. But actually in the 14th century, lots of people thought this was bizarre and ridiculous as well. And I think it would be great if the film sort of got at this sense that people think about law and judgment and right and wrong and the role of divine intervention in really interesting ways. I don't think that's quite the point of the film, though, so I'm quite surprised if that's what it's about.
That was Professor Hannah Skoda. If you'd like to read Hannah's article on medieval violence against women that I mentioned in the interview, you can find that at historyextra.com/last-duel-violence. Hannah has also written a feature on medieval trials by combat for the November issue of BBC History magazine. That's on sale now and also includes pieces on tanks in the Second World War, George III, and the rivalry between Elizabeth I and Mary, Queen of Scots. The Last Duel is released in UK cinemas today, October the 15th. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. We'll be back tomorrow when Marilena Kars will be talking about a rebellion in 1763.